Okay, you should have grabbed a handout on your way in. I've entitled this one, Protestant Developments Moving Forward into the 17th Century. So we start, first of all, by talking about Queen Elizabeth. And her reign in England was from 1558 to 1603. So she was just on the tail end of the 16th century and opened it up the 17th century. And it was during her reign that the controversy of the Puritans versus separatists started to occur. Now you remember that the Church of England had pretty much become the official state church of the Kingdom of England. King Henry VIII is the one that actually started that. His son Edward continued it. But then a daughter, Mary Queen of Scots, or not Mary, Bloody Mary, gets in charge. And of course, she's Roman Catholic. And she wants to take it all back to Catholicism. A lot of persecution of Protestants during the very short period of time that she was in charge. But as soon as she's dead and Elizabeth comes to the throne, it goes back to Church of England is basically the state church. She is the governor of the Church of England, just like she's the Queen of England. And they basically say everybody has to be loyal to the Queen and her church. And you have to use the Common Book of Prayer, which is the order of worship, what prayers are supposed to be prayed during the worship service, when they're supposed to be studying what, and it also has rules in it that gives the state philosophy of faith. And if you didn't like it, then you were pretty much called a dissenter and you faced all sorts of penalties. But here's what happened, is that during the 1560s and the 70s, the Puritans arise within the Church of England movement. They see too much Catholicism left. They see things being referred to in Catholic ways. And in particular, this is one of the things that really started ticking people off, is that people were dressing in the exact same type of official garments that the Roman Catholic priests used whenever they did their mass. And the Puritans are like, no, we need to purify that stuff out of the Church of England. It needs to be gone. And so that's how they got their name, the Puritans. They wanted to purify what remained of Roman Catholic tradition within the Church of England. Okay, does that make sense then? Everybody understand why they got their name then? All right, now in the 1570s, going into the 1580s, problems arise up in Scotland, because Scotland was a Presbyterian church. It was a kingdom separate from England. They won't be joined together until the next guy. So they have a Presbyterian form of state church government. And here's the difference, is that in the Presbyterian form, the various churches are led by local groups of elders. The word in Greek for elder is presbyteros, and so Presbyterian comes from that idea of an elder-led church. While the Church of England had an episcopal form of church government, which means that you've got this hierarchy where you start with the queen right now, and then it goes to the archbishops. The word episcopal is related to the word for bishop. So you've got all these archbishops, and then underneath them you've got other regional bishops, and then under them you start having the priests and the deacons and things like that. So it was a very much top-down control, while the Presbyterian was much more local control that was not tied into some ultimate leader. Well, some of the Scottish Puritan exiles, the ones that were actually pushing for this Church of Scotland to be less like Rome, they end up coming to England and they start rabble-rousing for the Church of England needs to be more Presbyterian, not Episcopalian. And, of course, that causes even more trouble with dissenting that's going on. So Parliament, on behalf of the Queen, responded by passing some laws that prohibited deviation from the authorized forms of worship within the Church of England. And here's kind of some of the ones that they did. 1583, they put out a law that said that you could be punished for preaching without authorization of the Church of England. So no independent preachers out there. You're supposed to be licensed. And that was a big problem because they really didn't preach in the Church of England. I didn't know if you were aware of that. But typically, the Church of England practiced pretty much the same thing that the Catholic Church did. You had a special mass or service where everything was focused on the ultimate Eucharist moment, because you've got to have that sacrifice of Jesus that's focused on. They might have the reading of some Bible passage here, another Bible passage there, and maybe a very short homily, a few, you know, words to say, but the majority of the service was the ceremony that was the exact same every single time. And so a bunch of these Puritans, they wanted to have true Bible preaching. But because they were also preaching against, you know, the Church of England being okay, the Church of England tried to shut them down by making this law. You can't preach unless we authorize it. Also, they could not baptize people and could not offer communion without that license. So, control from top down. 1585 is a big, long law about the expulsion of Jesuit priests. And in the law, it explains that the Parliament felt that there were Jesuit spies coming into England from Europe with the intention of undermining the authority of the Queen and the Church of England. And so they gave a short period of time for every last one of those Jesuits that were there without permission to be out of the country. It is not. It is a form of priesthood that is particularly focused on defense of Catholicism and defense of the Pope's authority. When you hear about Jesuits, they're almost always thought of as like the special forces of Roman Catholicism. That is correct. The Spanish Inquisition happened the century before this, but it was still being carried out in some form or fashion, and the Jesuits were the ones in charge of that. That is correct. Like I said, they're kind of the special enforcement patrol for Roman Catholicism, which was why they were coming into England, is because England was, in their mind, was being stolen from the Pope's authority and from the Church. And they wanted to put a stop to that. And the Church of England, of course, and the Parliament and the Queen said, no, we're not going to have any of that. All those people have to be out of here. And if they get caught after that, severe penalties. In 1593, you had a mandatory imprisonment for nonconformity. That act was specifically directed toward the Puritan separatists. So we're starting to see the emergence of another type of Puritan, because the original Puritans wanted to purify the Church of England of Roman Catholic influence. The separatists said, well, it's not doing any good. They're shutting us down on every occasion. So you know what? We should just separate from the Church of England and be totally independent, because they don't want to let us do this stuff anyway. So we might as well be totally separated. So this act was basically targeted against them to imprison them, mandatory imprisonment, if you were not conforming to the Church of England standards. Same year, there was also an act which restricted all Catholics, including native-born British Catholics, to within 5 miles of their house. This was to stop them from spreading their Catholicism anywhere else. That was the goal of the Church of England and Parliament in making that rule. If you got caught as a Catholic 5 miles away from your official residence, you could be thrown in jail, and if it was repeated offenses, you could be executed. No, they are being punished, but their idea is it didn't do us any good to be on the inside trying to fix it because we got punished. So we might as well be outside the church and just be official about it and say, fine, we're separatists, and we know if we get caught, we will be punished. But they were trying to be surreptitious about it, very much like the Roman Catholics were trying to be too. Roman Catholics tried to hold their own little quiet masses and things. You can see on this, if you were a Roman Catholic, you basically had your own little pet priest that lived with you. Because 5 miles, you can't go outside of that to go to Mass somewhere. It has to happen at your house. And so that you'll see some big homes that used to have chapels. And some of that was kind of related to that, is that they needed to have their own home place of worship to do their Mass. So you can see the crackdown here of the Church of England is basically the government crackdown on anything that deviates from their church system. And that's why the next things start happening. Okay, 1603, Elizabeth dies, and James becomes the new King of England. This is King James that we are very familiar with. He had actually been King of Presbyterian Scotland since 1566. So he's been the head of the Presbyterian Church of Scotland for a long time. But now, because of the way that ascension to the throne of England happens, he becomes King James I of England as well. And so England and Scotland are all together now. Just a couple of years after he becomes king, it is obvious to the Catholics in England that he is not going to be a friend to them, despite the fact that he's married to a Catholic. Now, we find that kind of weird. It's like, what? Why would a Protestant be married to a Catholic? Well, remember, these are kings and queens and princesses and princes, and they arrange their marriages based on political ties. And so it doesn't matter that he was a Presbyterian king of Scotland. The marriage arrangement that needed to happen was to marry him off to a, I think, Catholic princess from I think she was from Germany or somewhere in Europe, but she was a Catholic. Well, on 5 November 1605, you've got the gunpowder plot that fails. And every year in England, they still celebrate Guy Fawkes Day. They burn the guy in effigy, and they go around, the kids go around begging penny for the guy and all of this. It's an interest. It's their fireworks night, by the way. We lived there for 3 years, and it is an interesting evening, a big bonfire and fireworks. Because Guy Fawkes and a bunch of other dissident Catholics got it in their head, well, we need to solve our problem by blowing up King James and his parliament when they're in joint session. So they took whole bunches of barrels of gunpowder and packed them in the tunnels underneath parliament. And they were going to blow it up because by blowing him up, the next person in line to come to the throne was his 9-year-old daughter. And they believed that since she had a Catholic mommy, that she would be raised a Catholic queen. And so that was their solution to the problem. And it got found out and didn't happen. But of course, Catholics came under even more state persecution because of that. Because now they're trying to kill off the king in order to have their faith be put back in charge in England. 1604 to finally 1610 is really when it becomes official. Jamestown becomes the first permanent English settlement in what's going to become the United States. Now, England had been sending crews to the New World for quite some time in order to get resources brought back to England. When the New World was first discovered, it was pretty much looked at as it's just a great big new resource bin that we can pull stuff out of. And so you got the French going up into Canada and down the Great Lakes and the Mississippi down into the Gulf of Mexico, and they're grabbing furs and all sorts of lumber and things like that. You've got the Spaniards, they're going up through the Caribbean and across Florida and down into what eventually becomes Mexico, and they're grabbing slaves and gold and silver and wood and all that sort of stuff. And the Brits and the Dutch, they're all putting their stuff along the Atlantic coast of North America, and they're trying to set up fur posts and lumber places and fishing places. And so they're all basically just trying to get what they can out of the New World for the Old World. That's the goal. But Jamestown gets finally established as the one that sticks as people actually live there. But the people who were involved in the Jamestown project were mostly interested in financial gain. Some of them actually thought that they were going to go to the New World and just find gold and silver laying on the beach. And they were also fairly high placed in society, and they didn't want to work. And so Jamestown almost failed. It wasn't until Captain John Smith got put in charge, and he said, "This is going to be the principle we live by." Something from Paul in Thessalonians. "He who does not work shall not eat." And that's the only reason probably that Jamestown survived, is because a biblical principle was finally put in place there. Jamestown then was part of what's referred to as the Virginia Colony. And it goes way up the Atlantic coast to the north. It's huge. And it is a place that they are now going to start settling English people. But the Church of England is the official church of the colony because it is an English colony. 1604 was also the date or the year that King James authorized a new translation of the Bible into English from the original manuscripts. It was finished in 1611. And what do we know this translation as of today? The King James Version. And that is exactly where that language comes from, is because he authorized it. And it was for the authorized use in the Church of England. If you have a King James Bible and you open it up, there'll be a place somewhere in it, more than likely, still to this day, that will have the crest of England for King James and show that it is the authorized version to be used in churches. And that's how the King James also gets called authorized version, the AV. No other English versions were permitted to be used in the Church of England. If you got caught using the Geneva Bible, that's not authorized. You can't do that. Okay, any comments or questions up to this point? I don't know that there were a lot of differences. Other than the fact that I believe it's the Geneva Bible that has notes attached to it that are reformed in nature and therefore not in line with a lot of the stuff that the Church of England taught. And so that would be also one of the other controlling factors, is they didn't want any of that separatist, reformed, or Puritan stuff coming into the Church of England by means of the Bible that's used. Oh, you'd probably be fined big time for the first time, and then you'd be probably in prison the second time. And if you kept doing it, well, you know the ultimate thing is, well, you're a traitor against the governor of the Church of England, Her Majesty, or in this case, His Majesty, the head of the church. And because treason is always punishable by death, that might be the final resolution to the problem. 1620, we're coming up on the time of year where we know this date pretty well. Plymouth Colony was founded by the Scrooby Separatists. Scrooby is the name of a town in England. That is where they originally started in having their unauthorized separatist worship and study times. And they finally got tired of paying penalties and being in prison. And so they took off to first the Netherlands, and then they went to Holland trying to find religious freedom. The problem they ran into in Holland in particular was Holland didn't care about religious stuff at all. And because they didn't care about religious stuff at all, sure, you could have religious freedom there, but guess what? The society was not very nice. And so they were concerned that they were starting to lose their kids. Their kids were speaking more Dutch and acting more like the local Dutch people than they were being separatist Englanders. And so they said, okay, we know that King James is allowing people to go to the New World and start colonies or new settlements. So they applied for that ability, and so they got to go in 1620. And not everybody from the congregation went, because there wasn't enough room or finances. You know that they had a rough crossing because they started late because they had problems with their secondary ship. And even the one they took had problems too, the Mayflower. And only about half of them made it through that voyage and the first winter. It was rough. And they were also city people. They didn't know how to live off the land, that sort of stuff. And if it weren't for Squanto, helping them out, they wouldn't have made it. And so that's why in 1621, you've got the official first Thanksgiving, because the only reason they survived was the intervention of the locals, and they were very thankful for that to God. Yep, Elder Brewster. There we go. We've got a Mayflower descendant right here.
We have it all in writing.
Cool. Well, the thing is, though, let's understand that because of the weather problems, they landed in the far north of the Virginia Territory, the Virginia colony. And so that's why they decided they needed to have a different rule to their colony. And that's how Massachusetts got started as an independent colony. They would apply to King James for a special waiver and get their own little documents. But they are the ones who wrote the very first English government document in what will become the United States. It's called the Mayflower Compact. And in it, when you read the text of it, it is very clear they intended it to be governed by separatist Christian principles. Very, very clear. And that is part of the Christian history of North America, particularly the United States, is that's the first document. But this starts something, because Plymouth becomes successful as a separatist colony, and you've got more and more ships showing up there with more and more separatists. And it starts this flood where a lot of the separatists and dissenters, not just of England, but of Europe itself, the people who are not happy with state churches telling them what they can or cannot believe or can or cannot worship or which language Bible they can use, they see this as an opportunity to start fresh. And so there is this huge flood during the 1600s, the rest of the 1600s, of Protestants coming to the eastern seaboard of North America. And that is, in large part, the reason why, when the United States got started, it was started as a Christian nation. Now, it did not have a federal church. The First Amendment made very clear that it was not going to have a federal church. But every last one of the colonies had their own documents that said that they were going to be Christian colonies. Some of them more specified than others, and we'll talk about some of those next week. But that is where an awful lot of people have their heritage. If your family goes back to probably the 1600s or early 1700s, chances are your first crossing relatives were dissenters of some sort. They were very serious about their faith. Okay, I know Deb and I we've done our stuff back, and we've got relatives. They're not Mayflower, but they're tied in with all that dissenter wave that came afterwards, which is why the United States has the highest percentage of Christians in the entire world per capita. We've got about 11% of all the Christians in the world living in the United States because of the beginnings of this history. 1623, we'll have one more colony that gets started that we need to probably talk about, and that's New Hampshire. It began as an English fishing colony, so it was all about the money, you know, sending the resources back, salting the fish. But since it was an established colony, guess what? Many of the dissenters, many of the Presbyterians and the separatists, the congregations, they see it as, oh, well, this one's already established, we'll just move there. And that's where we'll have our faith freely. And it was up in the north. And as a general rule, the northern colonies were dissenter colonies. The southern colonies were Church of England colonies, which feeds into the Civil War. Because guess what? Church of England was all about the bottom line, and the importation of slaves under English law was to help that bottom line. And so the southern colonies tended to be slave owners by intention. And the Church of England protected that. And that will feed into the story later. Any last comments on that before we go to the back page? Because this is a totally different topic. It's related, but it's going to be different. Okay? Nope. On the back page, we need to talk about Calvinism versus Arminianism. Because this all popped up in the beginning of the 1600s in Europe. You've basically got John Calvin, who's now dead in the early 1600s, his followers are strong supporters of his teaching. But you've got another guy by the name of Jacob Arminius who rose up and then died, and he's got followers that are very strong followers of his teaching, and his teaching was basically anti-Calvin. In about 1611... the Arminians put out a rule of five articles against Calvinism. This is called the Articles of Dort, I think. It's in the Netherlands. The Calvinists, 10 years later, in 1619, they put out their response to it. Very strong response to it. And this ultimately allows both groups to kind of get their theology systematized. And we usually think of the Calvinists first, and then the Arminians as the response to the Calvinists. But they are enemies of one another. And it's represented typically by the mnemonic device. This is a modern thing. They didn't actually use this. This is modern. A mnemonic device called TULIP. And TULIP represents the five major beliefs of Calvinism. The T stands for total depravity. That is, individuals sin because they are naturally born sinners. They are totally depraved from birth. And they teach, just like Augustine taught, babies cry because they're sinners and they are not getting their way. It's a clear evidence that they are self-centered and sinners from the day they're born because they cry. Now that gets into one of the hymns that we sing around Christmas. Away in the manger, the baby awakes, no crying he makes because Jesus does not have sin. So I'm sure Jesus cried when he was hungry and dirty, just like every baby does, okay? Because I reject total depravity, and I'll go over one of the reasons, several of the reasons biblically for that. But that is what the Calvinists taught, total depravity. Now, here's the weird thing. Jacob Arminius and his followers, the Arminians, they agreed with that. They agreed that everyone was born a natural sinner. However, they believed that God would give prevenient or preceding grace to all individuals when they're born so that they might freely choose to be saved at some place down the line. Now that is that's a fine distinction, but it is a big distinction as far as the Calvinists were concerned. because of the rest of their teachings, which every last one of these, the Arminians disagree with. The U stands for unconditional election. That is, God chooses or elects those who would be saved before they're ever born. And of course, if he chooses those who are going to be saved, what does that also mean? He chooses those who are lost. Now, there is a group of Calvinists who emphasize that, and they're usually referred to as double predestinarians. But the fact of the matter is, all Calvinists believe that the saved are chosen by God, and whether they like to talk it about or not, they also believe God has decided who will be lost before they're ever born. You can't have the one without the other. Now, the Arminians disagreed with that, which is why they were hated by the Calvinists. They believe that individuals can exercise free will on whether or not to be saved or lost. Now, they would say, though, God gives you the ability to make that choice. You are not naturally born with that ability to choose. God gave it to you because you were born a sinner, but God wanted to give you the chance to be saved. Now, I've got a problem with that. I think they should have just disagreed from day one on the whole thing, from the first point onward, and I would have been fine being an Arminian. I am not an Arminian because of point one. I can't agree with that. But I have Arminian tendencies because of the rest of the points. The L stands for limited atonement. And that is basically this. Since God knows who's going to be saved because he chose them, Jesus Christ only died for those people. Nobody else. What's that? Well, it does seem to go against Scripture, but remember, they are starting from some of these philosophical viewpoints from the past, which is basically God is absolutely sovereign in everything, which means he decides who's saved and lost, which means he's not going to waste the precious blood of his son on those that are going to be lost. So the atonement has to be limited. See, it's a philosophical chain that follows. There is logic to it, but as you know, if your starting premise is faulty, all the logical things that follow from it, while logical, can also be faulty. Now, the Arminians, of course, saw that there was a fault with this, and they disagreed. So they said, no, the atonement is potentially available to everyone, because everyone has the ability to freely choose. Now, God gave them the ability to freely choose, but because the choice is there, the potential of the atonement is there. It's just not effective unless it's chosen. And I would agree with that. The I stands for irresistible grace. And that means that if you are on God's list of saved, you can't resist his call to be saved, to go through the public motion of becoming part of the saved. And this is what the Calvinists believe is happening, is it's all being played out in front of us, is that God is the only one who knows who the saved are. Even the saved don't know it until it happens. And then they know that they're saved because they've been irresistibly drawn to it. Now that has something to do with Calvin's own experience. He felt that something changed in him that opened his mind and made him more desirable to get to know God. And we've got Augustine, who also has something similar. I think he was the one that had a thunderstorm that scared him or something. But something happened where he felt that he had been finally brought to the understanding, I'm part of the saved, and I need to start acting like that. And you will have Calvinist churches that will talk about, our brother here needs to give his testimony today as to why he now knows he's saved. Because something will have happened. Ever heard anybody talking about, you know, I have a testimony to tell because this is how I found out that I was saved? That's Calvinist. Okay? Now, of course, the Arminians disagreed with that because they said all individuals have the free will given to them by God to resist God's saving grace. So just because God extends his grace and it's very persuasive, God leaves in place the free will that he gave you that you could say, no, not interested. I don't want to live that way. I don't want to give up the stuff that I like to do. And of course, again, the Calvinists and the Arminians really hate each other because of the disagreement on that. Actually, I don't think they are Calvinistic. I think they are Arminian. The 144,000 is a slightly different twist. It's the idea that God selects a certain group within the saved to be specially saved. And they kind of mutated their ideas over the years because they're... Well, yeah, and that's the problem they ran into. They thought that Jesus would come back and there would only be 144,000 Jehovah's Witnesses. But it didn't happen that way. And so now they've had to kind of tweak it where, well, that's just the special group of Jehovah's Witnesses. All right. Last point of TULIP is the P, perseverance of the saints. Or as you probably better know it, once saved, always saved. Now that is probably too crass a way to describe this because you need to understand the Calvinistic mindset. This is what they believe. If you have been chosen by God before the foundation of the earth to be part of the saved, and you are irresistibly drawn by his grace into the understanding that you are saved, then there is no way in the world that you could be unsaved, ever. Because that would mess up all the other points in front of there. So if you are the saved, or if you belong to the saved, then of course you will be saved for eternity. And the explanations, of course, would be if somebody that looks like they're part of the saved then dies unsaved, what's the Calvinistic answer? They never really were saved. They just looked like it. They were just faked. But it matches their theology based on these 5 points. Now, of course, the Arminians say, no, we disagree with that. They believe that all individuals retain this God-given free will to, if they wish, to return to a life of sin. After they'd gone through the motions of being saved, they could return back into the life of sin and be lost because they fell back outside God's saving grace. Now, there are extreme Arminians who believe that you're saved, lost, saved, lost, saved, lost, saved, lost all day long. You're just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Mid-level ones think that you've got like days that you're saved and then days you're not saved. And then there are others, and I would tend more toward this, that there are seasons sometimes in certain people's lives that they have been saved and they're acting like it, and then out of the stupidity of their own heart, they go back in to the immoral lifestyle. And if we follow church discipline, we basically challenge them on that on the way out. And then we finally say, okay, you clearly do not want to be part of Christ's church. You are now excommunicated. We'll check back with you from time to time, or you need to check in with us if you change your mind. But as Paul says, you've now been turned over to Satan. You are officially, as far as we can tell, lost again. And you need to be saved. And I think that is probably the closer biblical approach to it, that it's tied into church discipline as to whether or not a person has, quote, lost his salvation. See, lost is not appropriate, because lost indicates unintentional. The word in Greek, apostasy, means to step away or stand away, which communicates intention. And it is frightening to see people who have done that. There are places on the internet that you can find where people leave video testimony saying, I hereby renounce my faith in Jesus Christ. I blaspheme the Holy Spirit and will never, ever stand up for any of the things that I formerly said. And I'm like, dude, that is not good. And thankfully, some people have come back from that. And very embarrassing, though. I mean, that's a Hebrews 6 passage where you come back from that sort of thing, you shame Jesus Christ all over again by crucifying him. And it's a sad situation altogether. All right, so any questions or comments just on that little chart there? I hope that helps you understand Calvinism and its analog or its opposite, Arminianism. But I want you to really see the biblical considerations on this. First of all, Deuteronomy 24:16 says, fathers shall not be put to death for their sons, nor shall sons be put to death for their fathers. Everyone shall be put to death for his own sin. That's God himself issuing that testimony about criminal acts. And in the history of Israel, there was a time where a king came to power because his dad was assassinated, and the people around him wanted to kill the whole families of the people who were the instigators of that assassination. And that king said, no, that would be a violation of this Mosaic law. We will only execute the ones who carried out the plot. Their families cannot be punished for it. Yes, but when that happens, the examples that you can give, Achan is one of those. There is good reason to believe everybody in that tent where Achan hid the stuff was aware that it was there. So they became complicit in the crime. And so they were executed for their own sin. When Saul's sons are executed because of atrocities that have been committed, they were old enough, certainly, and even though the text is not explicit about it, there's every reason to believe they were participants in the atrocities. And therefore, they were executed for their own crime, not because of their dad. Now, will consequences follow? Yes. When criminals are executed, their kids are left without a dad. Their wives, or if it flips the other way, their husbands or spouses are left without their spouse. And there are consequences that follow from that. But they are not being executed for the crime of the other person. Now, the reason I always emphasize all that is because I can't see it. I personally doubt that God would violate his own principle in order to assign eternal punishment in hell for the children of Adam because of Adam's sin. I think that is one of the better Old Testament passages that kicks Calvinism in its head, that God does not impute to everybody else the sin guilt of Adam. Now, have we all sinned in the same vein as Adam? Yes. Were we brought into that sin because of a lot of the stuff that was going on in our fallen world because of Adam? Yes. I honestly think that what happens is when you're born into a world of sin. And it's full of temptation, it's full of all sorts of difficulties, and as you're a little bitty kid, you are naturally only focused on self. You have to be. When you're a little bitty kid, you cry because you can't communicate any other way. I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, I'm dirty, I need changed, I need somebody to hug me or hold me. That's how little children communicate. But as they grow older, the natural thing that's supposed to be taught to them is you are not the center of the world. There are other people that need to be taken into consideration. And what will happen is, as we grow through that time period, we will often choose to be selfish, regardless of us being told that's wrong. And that is where our sin problem starts being personal. All sin, at its base, is rooted in self-centered choices. That's my philosophy, okay? And I believe it's biblically upheld. And I think that sin is a choice all of us have made. Now, Jesus, of course, is going to be the exception to that. And the book of Hebrews says that. He was tempted, you know, being part of this world, he was tempted in all ways like unto ourselves, but he did not sin. That did not happen because it was impossible for him to sin, but it happened because he, of his own free will in human form, said, no, there is a better choice to be made here. And he made the good choice every single time. Now, Ezekiel 18, which is a passage that we can't go over, we don't have the time, but it is one that I insist everybody who is having trouble with Calvinism should read over and over and over again. In that passage, among other things, God says, the soul, which is the Hebrew way of saying the individual, the soul who sins will die. And it would appear from God's own testimony in that passage that he treats everyone as individuals. And when it comes to eternal destiny, and that their free will choice plays a role in his justice. That passage has people whose parents are sinners, but they are saints, and they're saved, and their parents are lost. And then it flips it. You could have somebody who was saved as a parent, and then you become the sinner, and you're the one that's lost. Or, it even gives the example, someone who starts out in their life righteous, but then chooses to become unrighteous, and they die in that unrighteousness, they are lost. And those that start out unrighteous, and then they realize, I need to be righteous, so they become righteous, and they are saved, because that's where they finish. And so I think Ezekiel chapter 18 is one of the best passages to really kick Calvinism in its head. Jesus said, when talking about little children, and I've got the parallels there, Matthew 18, Mark 10, Luke 18, he said that little children represent the kingdom of heaven, and that everybody else needs to become like a little child if you want to be part of heaven. And then he also says anybody who leads one of these kids into sin would be better off to drown himself before that ever happened. Now, those words from Jesus do not sound to me like a description of a class that was born lost and on their way to hell. It sounds like a class that starts out innocent and it is disastrous when they become lost. And so that's another place that I reject the idea of total depravity. And then the last one, and you hear me pushing this as a memory verse all the time. Paul writes, "No temptation has overtaken you except that which is common to all mankind. God is faithful," meaning he is trustworthy. "God is faithful in that he will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able. And with that temptation will provide a way of escape that you may be able to endure it." I believe that is God's guarantee that no one has been or will ever be put into a situation where they have no choice but to sin. Now, some people say, well, that's only a promise to Christians. You can make that claim all you want, but I think that it probably is a universal claim because God puts a lot of value in other passages, like the ones we already read, in free will. And he wants us to be holy as he is holy. He wants us to choose life. He wants us to do the right thing. And so I think Calvinism is bad philosophy, and I also think it teaches people not to be accountable. It is awfully easy for people taught on Calvinistic training to say, well, I couldn't help myself. After all, I'm just a sinner. And yet, God says, no, you are accountable. You need to repent of your sin. You need to confess that you're the violator. See, that's another thing that we see in the conversion process, is you have to acknowledge, I'm the sinner. And I'm the one that needs the Savior. Yeah, Adam sinned, so did Eve, all those people that came before me, sure, they all did, but I'm the one that did it. I'm the one that got myself in trouble. And I think that is a much more biblical approach to evangelism, is to bring people to that accountability status. Okay, I used up every last moment of our time. So if you've got things that you want to talk about on this topic, jot them down, remind yourself, okay? Bring the sheet back next week, and I'll try to remember very first thing to go. Okay, anything from last week? And then we'll start with that.